and support to the chairman's vision of a jump forward into communism. In October 1957, he had already suggested that we must fight to expand exports and imports so that we can gradually become a large importer and large exporter. A few weeks later, he argued that if we want to build socialism, we need to import technology, equipment, steel, and other necessary materials. Larger imports and larger exports, an idealistic policy that ran roughshod over the actual capacity of the country to export foodstuffs and materials, became a major catchphrase in 1958. It suited Mao, who could show off the success of his policies on the international stage. Once he had asserted his authority over his colleagues and silenced those who were critical of the Great Leap Forward, few leaders thought it wise to argue in favour of financial discipline. As the projected output of industry and agriculture was ceaselessly revised upwards, so the quantity of imports rose. In other words, a tightening of foreign trade was feasible only once Mao recognized the failure of the Great Leap Forward. Politics was in command, and an overshoot in imports was seen not as a sign of budgetary indiscipline, but as an indication of boundless faith in the power of the masses to transform the economy. The purpose of spending on capital goods imported from abroad was to create the capacity to produce machinery and manufactured goods, catapulting the economy into a dramatically higher level of industrial development, which would ultimately free China from its economic dependence on the Soviet Union. Mao had few opponents at home. Abroad, in the Soviet bloc, leaders may have harbored doubts about the Great Leap Forward, but increased quantities of foodstuffs shipped from China suited them well. Khrushchev, after all, was shifting the emphasis in the Soviet economy away from heavy industry towards the needs of consumers, and defiantly promising to overtake the USA in per capita production of meat, milk, and butter. In East Germany, Ulbricht was desperate to stop the flow of people who voted with their feet by escaping to West Germany. He too made extravagant claims, announcing at the Fifth Party Congress in 1958 that a socialist society was in the making, as the per capita quantity of consumer goods would soon catch up and overtake that of West Germany, a process envisaged to be completed by 1961. In the meantime, he collectivized the countryside, causing severe food shortages which only increased reliance on imports from China. East German leaders may have had doubts about the size of the 1958 crop in China, but they were keen on more foodstuffs. Not only did rice become a staple food in East Germany during the Great Leap Forward, but the margarine industry depended on imports of edible oils from China. Trade delegates pushed hard for greater imports of animal fodder, tobacco, and peanuts. Such was the pressure that in June 1959, a Chinese trade representative was forced to explain that the fodder exported for pigs in Germany was needed to feed people in China. China not only exported more to its Soviet bloc allies, but also started dumping products in Asia and Africa. At the 40th anniversary of the October Revolution in Moscow, Khrushchev had triumphantly declared his intention to catch up with the United States in the production of farm products. He also announced a trade offensive. "We declare war on you in the peaceful field of trade," he threatened, starting a worldwide economic initiative designed to cripple U.S. foreign trade and lure the economies of developing nations into the Soviet embrace. Russia sold tin, zinc and soybean products at prices nobody could match, and delivered lorries, cars and machinery in the Middle East at less than production cost, often with loans offering low interest rates and preferential repayment terms. In a planned economy which subordinated economics to politics, the Soviet Union could overpay for raw materials, ignore market prices, and sustain heavy losses to win influence around the globe. China was goaded into its own trade war, dumping goods as if they were all surplus to internal demand in the age of plenty brought about by the Great Leap Forward. Bicycles, sewing machines, thermos flasks, canned pork, fountain pens, all sorts of goods were sold below cost to demonstrate that the country was ahead of the Soviet Union in the race for true communism. In the British colony of Hong Kong, raincoats made in China sold for 40% less than in Guangzhou. Leather shoes went for $1.50 per pair, frozen quail for 8 cents each, violins for $5. But the main enemy in the economic war against imperialism was Japan, and China did its best to undercut its rival in soybean oil, cement, structural steel, and window glass. Most of all, clothes became the battlefield where communist supremacy had to be asserted, as products from grey sheeting to cotton prints flooded the market. The cost of exporting goods below economic cost was enormous for a country living on the edge. In 1957, some 8.7 million bolts of cloth were exported for more than $50 million. In the first 9 months of 1958 alone, 9.2 million bolts found their way onto the international market, bringing in a mere $47 million, or 12% less. By the end of the year, as poor farmers in the countryside were facing a winter without cotton padded clothes, some 14 million bolts had been sold abroad below cost. All that was done in order for China to be able to claim the title of the world's third largest exporter of cloth, instead of being fifth. As Yu Jiuquan acknowledged at a party conference on foreign trade at the end of 1958, flooding the market with goods below cost had been a disaster, as more had been sold than before, but for far less revenue. We really hurt ourselves, we frightened our friends, and we awakened our enemies. I hear that in the Ministry of Foreign Trade, some people sign contracts in a very casual way. Who allowed you to export that much? Zhuan Lai inquired, distancing himself from the scheme. We thought that we had a big cotton crop and would not encounter any problems, so we did not ask for permission, interjected Ma Yimin, an administrator from the Ministry of Foreign Trade. But neither the cotton crop nor the grain crop, nor, for that matter, industrial output, was anywhere near what had been pledged during the Great Leap Forward. China had a yawning trade deficit. Promised deliveries to socialist allies were not met. Only a third of an agreed 2,000 tons of frozen poultry had been handed over to East Germany in 1958, and Walter Ulbricht demanded the rest in time for Christmas. East Germany was owed some 5 to 7 million rubles, Hungary 1.3 million, Czechoslovakia 1.1 million, and all of them requested compensation in the shape of rice, peanuts, or animal hides. Zhu agreed to free up an extra 15,000 tons of rice and 2,000 tons of peanuts for Hungary and Czechoslovakia. He also brushed aside Zhu De's policy of large imports, large exports. Noting a shortfall of 400 million yuan in exports to the socialist bloc for 1958, he declared that we are against large imports and large exports, as foreign trade must be measured. How should the shortfall be addressed? Zhou Enlai was the first to state in November 1958 that I would rather that we don't eat or eat less and consume less, as long as we honour contracts signed with foreigners. To take goods without anything in return is not in the style of socialism, he added a few weeks later. Deng Xiaoping chimed in, if everybody could just save a few eggs, a pound of meat, a pound of oil and 6 kilos of grain, the entire export problem would simply vanish. Li Xianyan, Li Fuchun and Bo Yibo agreed. In order to construct socialism and build a better future, people will agree to eat a little less if we explain the reasons. In order to honour foreign obligations, exports for 1959 were substantially increased from 6.5 to 7.9 billion yuan, while imports grew only 3% to 6.3 billion. Grain earmarked for foreign markets, for instance, was doubled to 4 million tons. Some readers may think that this was merely a few percentages of the total grain output, but in a poor country, a few million tons made the difference between life and death. As Wang Rensong bitterly pointed out in 1961, when the country was groping for a way out of the famine, Hubei province, of which he was leader, received 200,000 tons from Beijing to fight mass starvation in 1959, but the state exported more than 4 million tons the same year. The responsibility for reaching export targets was passed on to provincial leaders, each region being given a proportion of the national target. But in the winter of 1958-9, provincial bosses were confronted with growing shortfalls. By January 1959, a mere 80,000 tons of grain for export had been procured nationwide. The following month, Hubei refused to provide more than 23,000 out of a planned 48,000, while Li Jingkan agreed to come up with two-thirds of Sichuan's quota, making up the rest in a variety of inferior grains. In Anhui, Zheng Xisheng approved the delivery of only 5,000 out of a planned 23,500 tons. Fujian handed over nothing. In other export commodities too, most provinces met only half of their export quota, and regions such as Guizhou, Gansu, and Qinghai slipped to below a third of their obligations. Complaints about non-delivery reached Beijing. Hospitals and kindergartens in Leningrad, for instance, were out of rice in the middle of winter. As the issue of foreign trade slipped out of control, it was discussed at a party meeting in Shanghai in March-April 1959. Mao stepped in and recommended vegetarianism as a solution. "We should save on clothing and food to guarantee exports. Otherwise, if 650 million people start eating a little more, our export surplus will all be eaten up. Horses, cows, sheep, chicken, dogs, pigs. Six of the farm animals don't eat meat, and aren't they all still alive? Some people don't eat meat either. Old Su didn't eat meat, and he lived till he was 80. I heard that Huang Yanpei didn't eat meat. He too lived to 80. Can we pass a resolution that nobody should eat meat, and that all of it should be exported?" Having heard the chairman's command, Peng Zhen, the mayor of Beijing, was willing to go even further, suggesting that the consumption of grain be cut as well in order to increase exports. Zhu Enlai, now emboldened, suggested that we should not eat any pork for 3 months so that we can guarantee meat exports. Besides meat, the use of edible oil was also curtailed. On the 24th of May 1959, an order was issued to all provinces, in the interests of the export market and the construction of socialism, no more edible oil should be sold in the countryside. But as the pressure to deliver increased, another problem appeared. Local units started cutting corners in order to meet their targets, leading to falling standards in the quality of exports. The Soviet Union lodged repeated complaints about the quality of meat, which was often contaminated by bacteria. Up to a third of the pork tins were rusty. Grievances were filed about other goods as well. Some 46,000 shoes sent to the Soviet Union had defects. Paper exported to Hong Kong was unusable. Batteries bought by Iraq were leaking, while the Swiss found that a fifth of the shipped coal consisted of stones. West Germany discovered salmonella in 500 tons of eggs, and in Morocco, a third of all pumpkin seeds bought from the People's Republic were infested with insects. The cost of replacing tainted merchandise delivered in 1959 amounted to 200 or 300 million yuan, while China also acquired a bad reputation abroad, which would prove difficult to shake. Still unable to overcome the growing trade deficit, Beijing undertook emergency measures in October 1959. The State Council directed that all commodities which could be reduced or eliminated from domestic consumption be squeezed, while any remaining shortfalls should be replaced by other obtainable goods. To back up the readjustment, a special export office was established to monitor both the quality and the quantity of all export commodities. Trade agreements were made on a calendar basis, and the new arrangements were part of an end-of-year drive to ensure the completion of export targets. This meant that pressure was added just as the country was entering winter. The amount of pork, for instance, was below quota, and in November a campaign was organized to procure an extra 9 million pigs before the end of the year. As 1959 came to an end, ruthless extraction meant that 7.9 billion yuan had been exported, in line with Zhou Enlai's target. Grain and edible oil reached 1.7 billion yuan. Of the 4.2 million tons of grain exported that year, 1.42 went to the Soviet Union, 1 million to Eastern Europe, and close to 1.6 million to capitalist countries. But despite all these efforts, it was simply not enough. The trade deficit with Eastern Europe in 1958 and with the Soviet Union in 1959 alone amounted to 300 million yuan. Tensions would come to a boil in the summer of 1960. Chapter 11. Dizzy with success. Mao had nudged, cajoled and bullied his colleagues into the great leap forward, launching the country into a race to catch up with more developed countries through breakneck industrialization and collectivization of the countryside. Leaders who had been wary about the pace of economic development had been publicly degraded and humiliated, while on the ground those critical of the leap had been swept away in a swirl of terror. Then, as the frenzy to come up with higher yields snowballed out of control and evidence about the damage on the ground accumulated, Mao turned around and started blaming everybody else for the disruptions that his campaign had created. A shrewd politician with an instinct for self-preservation honed by decades of political purges, he not only deflected the responsibility for the chaos onto the local party officials as well as his close colleagues, but also managed to portray himself as the benign leader concerned about the welfare of his subjects. During the process, which lasted from November 1958 to June 1959, the pressure temporarily abated, although the reprieve would turn out to be short-lived. Misinformation proliferated in the political order entrenched by Mao. The chairman was no fool. Understanding all too well that the one-party system he had contributed to building could generate false reports and inflated statistics. In all communist regimes, elaborate monitoring mechanisms existed to sidestep the official bureaucracy. Supreme leaders in particular had every interest in finding out about the problems which lower party officials preferred to keep to themselves, as failure to stay in touch could lead to a coup. Control organs supervised the formal workings of government bodies and party leaders, carrying out checks on finance, appointments, procedures and reporting. The state security, besides its usual tasks of preventing crime, running prisons and keeping the country safe, regularly surveyed popular opinion and gauged the extent of social discontent. In that capacity, the Minister of the Public Security Bureau was vital to Mao, and it is not surprising that he appointed Si Fuzhi to the job in 1959. Here, after all, was a leader who could be relied upon to tell the chairman the truth. At all levels of the party machinery, confidential reports were regularly issued on a whole range of topics, although, of course, these too could be biased. These, in turn, could be bypassed by sending trusted officials on fact-finding missions. This is what Mao did in October 1958, also taking to the road himself to tackle the problems of the people's communes directly with leading cadres in the provinces. As evidence about statistical inflation mounted, he became increasingly worried. In Wuchang, confronted with a critical report in which his close ally Wang Runzong showed that his province could produce 11 million tons of grain at most, instead of a projected 30 million tons, his confidence was dealt a blow, and he became dejected. A lifeline was provided by Zhao Ziyang, the secretary of Guangdong province. In a report to his boss, Tao Zhu, he revealed in January 1959 that many of the communes had hidden grain and hoarded cash. In a single county, some 35,000 tons were uncovered. Following up this clue, Zhao launched an anti-hiding campaign which turned up over 1 million tons of grain. Tao Zhu praised the report and sent it to Mao. Then came news from Anhui, under the leadership of radical Zheng Cixiang. The issue of so-called grain shortages in the countryside has nothing to do with lack of grain, nor is it linked to excessive state procurements. It is an ideological problem, in particular among local cadres. The report went on to explain that team leaders on the ground had four apprehensions, namely, that the communes would not provide them with sufficient grain, that other teams might purposely fail to pull their weight and hide a part of the harvest, that excess grain might be confiscated in the case of a spring famine, and that heavier quotas would follow if they fully declared their true grain output. Mao immediately circulated these reports, commenting that the problem of brigade leaders who hide grain and secretly divide it up is very serious. It worries the people and has an effect on the communist morality of local cadres, the spring crop, the enthusiasm for the Great Leap Forward in 1959, and the consolidation of the people's communes. The problem is widespread throughout the country and must be solved at once. Mao took on the pose of a benevolent sage king, protective of the welfare of his subjects. The wind of communism had blown over the countryside, he explained. As overzealous cadres had taken collectivization too far, randomly appropriating assets and labor in the name of the people's communes, the villagers had started to hide the grain. In March 1959, Mao even spoke with admiration for the strategies that the farmers adopted in evading grain procurements, threatening that he might join them if the party did not change its ways. "I now support conservatism. I stand on the side of right deviation. I am against egalitarianism and left adventurism. I now represent 500 million peasants and 10 million local cadres. It is essential to be right opportunists. We must persist with right opportunism. If you don't all join me in going to the right, then I will be a rightist on my own, and alone will face expulsion from the party." Only Mao could have used the label rightist, which would have spelled political death for anybody else, so flippantly, as he postured as the lonely hero daring to speak truth to power. As to the local cadres whom he blamed for the excesses, 5% should be purged. No need to shoot every one of them. A few months later, Mao quietly increased the quota to 10%. Mao also took his colleagues to task. The emperor, it seemed, had been misled by his close advisers. There was a bumper crop, but nothing like the fantastic claims made earlier in the campaign. Mao confronted the party bosses, repeatedly pouring scorn on outlandish predictions and demanding that projections for economic output be scaled back to more realistic levels. When a cautious Bo Yibo failed to cut back on industrial projects in March 1959, Mao was full of disdain. "What kind of people are running our industry? The spoilt sons of a rich family? What we need in industry right now is a Qin emperor type. You people in industry are too soft, always talking about justice and virtue, so much so that as a result you accomplish nothing. Particular blame was reserved for the close cronies who had so faithfully implemented his wishes. In front of the assembled leaders in Shanghai in April, Mao recollected, "When I convened a small meeting at the Bei Dai He conference in August, nobody objected when we discussed the targets for 1959. At the time I was mainly busy with the shelling of Kuai Moi. The question of the people's communes was not really mine. It was Tan Zhenlin who was in charge. I just wrote a few lines." About the resolution taken on the people's communes, he had the following thoughts. "That was somebody else's idea, not mine. I had a look at it, but I didn't understand it. I just had a faint impression that communes are good." Contributing to inflated targets were incomprehensible documents. "We should forbid all these incomprehensible documents from leaving the room. You are university students, professors, great Confucian minds. I am merely an ordinary student, so you should write in plain language." And in case anybody had any doubts about his leadership, he warned his colleagues, "Some comrades still have not acknowledged that I am the leader. Many people hate me, in particular Defense Minister Peng Dehuai. He hates me to death. My policy with Peng Dehuai is as follows. If you don't attack me, I won't attack you. But if you attack me, I for sure will attack you." Then Mao launched into a rambling tirade in which every party leader who had disagreed with him in the past was mentioned by name, including Liu Shaoqi, Zhu Enlai, Chen Yun, Zhu De, Lin Biao, Peng Dehuai, Li Bocheng, Chen Yi, even Run Bixi, who had long since passed away. Every leader present was named, with the exception of Deng Xiaoping. The point of the outburst was to show that Mao had been right all along, while those who had opposed him at one point or another in the party's past had all been wrong. Standing on the side of history, Mao was accountable to no one. And no one was left in any doubt about the overall correctness of his line and the primacy of success. Mao never missed a chance to lord the great leap forward. "No matter how many problems we have, in the final analysis it does not amount to more than one finger out of 10. To mistake a tenth for the whole was an error. Even to think that a campaign of such a momentous nature could have been launched without making a single mistake was an error. To doubt the great leap forward was an error, and to stand by and watch from a critical distance was an error." Mao could not be swayed from his overall strategy. In the first half of 1959, close cropping and deep ploughing continued unabated. Irrigation schemes proceeded apace, and collectivization went ahead. In a moment of retrenchment following an all-out drive to collectivize the countryside, Stalin had allowed farmers to leave the collective farms after he published an article entitled "Dizzy with Success" in 1930. Unlike his former patron, Mao did very little about the people's communes. He merely indicated that the brigade should be the basic accounting unit rather than the commune. Historians have interpreted this period as one of retreat or cooling off, but this was simply not the case. Deng Xiaoping made this clear to the lieutenants on the battlefield in February 1959. "We need to warm up, not cool down." Requisitions from the countryside to feed the cities and satisfy foreign clients were drastically increased precisely during this period. In the top-secret minutes distributed only to participants of a meeting held in the Jingjiang Hotel in Shanghai on the 25th of March, Mao ordered that a third of all grain be procured far above previous rates. "If you don't go above a third, people won't rebel. Regions that failed to fulfill their procurement quotas should be reported. This is not ruthless, it's realistic." The country had a bumper harvest, and Cardus should study the example of Hunan in raising procurements. "He who strikes first prevails. He who strikes last fails. Mao made an extra 16,000 lorries available.